I put the agenda on the sheet. It is imperative that medical professionals treat patients impartially, but various circumstances, that's actually imprecise, right? Because we don't want them to be impartial. We want them to be in favor of the patient's best interest. So impartially is actually maybe an imprecise word in that sense. But various circumstances may create conflicts of interest. These include having patients who are social acquaintances and relatives of medical professionals, as well as participating in trips and receiving other benefits from pharmaceutical companies. How do CPSO policy, College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, how do CPSO policy and Jewish ethics address these issues? That's what we're looking at. I gave you links to some past sessions on the sheet, sessions where I dealt with some of the topics that we're going to talk about, but perhaps in greater depth because we're dealing with a different range of topics here. So there was a two-part session in 2011 on confidentiality of patient data, and that's something that's certainly a very big topic. It will come into our discussion, but you can imagine that there where I spent two sessions on it, I dealt with aspects of it that we're not going to get to tonight. Then there was one of my favorite sessions. It was also a two-parter. There it was two-part because we did one, and then it was by popular demand, we did another, practicing medicine in the Jewish community. And that was a lot of fun, that topic. The Judaism and dementia care is a topic that we dealt with most recently. That was our December session. I included the link there because one of our discussions, the fifth vignette, is about taking care of a parent, and it's a case that we discussed in that session. So I put that there. And then I gave you three sessions which aren't medical at all. These are sessions on conflict of interest in legal settings or in financial services settings, in case that's a topic that's of interest to people. Okay, so I gave you the vignettes on the sheet, but we're not actually going to read them yet. We'll take them one by one as they come up, but they're there. You could take a look and see for yourself where it is that we are headed. The first thing that I wanted to do before launching into the vignettes, I see more people join, so I'm going to put the link in the chat once again for people to sign in. It's very important. If you want CME credit, you do have to sign in the chat. Being on the Zoom, even with your screen on, is not sufficient because I'm not writing down names of people who I see here, and I'm not taking screenshots. I need to just rely on the record that's in the chat. So you can do that by sending me a private message or a general one for everybody, but that's important. Okay, so I wanted to begin by talking about what the concerns are from a regulatory standpoint with conflicts of interest. So we start out by talking about the basic mission of the medical professional, which we already know. I actually mentioned it while reading the agenda. The mission is take care of the patient's best interest. If you take a look on the sheet, source number one from the CMA, Canadian Medical Association, Code of Ethics and Professionalism, Section B, Fundamental Commitments of the Medical Profession. The section on commitment to the well-being of the patient. Consider first the well-being of the patient. Always act to benefit the patient and promote the good of the patient. Now, obviously, there is a subjective element in that. The medical professional is deciding what is the best interest of the patient. But the point is the patient should come first and not other interests. Part of that means a commitment to integrity, avoiding any kind of influence which could bias the medical professional. So it says here, commitment to professional integrity and competence. Practice medicine competently, safely, and with integrity. Avoid any influence that could undermine your professional integrity. This obviously is very important for our discussion today. So as a result of that concern, of these, and these goals, the CMA is worried about outside influences which could weaken or warp the commitment to the welfare of the patient. That's what we're looking to avoid. Examples of that. So take a look on your sheet at source number two. This is from a CMA policy document, Guidelines for Physicians in Interaction with Industry. I only went with CMA because it's the largest body, as the Canadian Medical Association. I assume it's the largest body. But you could find very similar documents for the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario. So it says, the practicing physician's primary obligation is to the patient. Relationships with industry are inappropriate if they negatively affect the fiduciary nature of the patient-physician relationship. There is a duty of loyalty to the patient, and we're worried that if you get involved with industry, which is another word for business, you can end up in a position where you're biased and therefore unable to adequately serve the interest of the patient. So sometimes it may be a function of a financial interest. In source number three, we find out that sometimes it's an issue of moral commitments, religious conscience. So inform the patient when your moral commitments may influence your recommendation concerning provision of or practice of any medical procedure or intervention as it pertains to the patient's needs or requests. If you know you're not going to be comfortable recommending a particular course of action, you have a responsibility to let the patient know that you could be influenced by your personal conscience. It doesn't say not to practice, by the way, but it does say notify the patient. And then, still in source number three, family biases. Limit treatment of yourself, your immediate family, or anyone with whom you have a similarly close relationship to minor or emergency interventions, and only when another physician is not readily available. There should be no fee for such treatment. Don't charge your relatives. That's good advice in general. But the concern here, which we'll come back to, I hope, in the last vignette, is that you run into all sorts of problems when you treat family aside from the issue of a fee, and therefore only do it in emergency situations or for minor care. You can give them a Band-Aid. We're going to allow that. That's okay. This is not different from what you see in other professions. Meaning, if you were to go to that section that I gave you on the sheet with links to the business ethics and legal ethics classes, you'd find very similar ideas in the CPA Code of Professional Conduct for Ontario and in the Law Society of Ontario's Rules of Professional Conduct. There's plenty of material on those as well. But here's the key point, and then we'll be done with this kind of introductory phase. Their concern is not for intentional wrongdoing. That's not what we're talking about. It's not that you're going to have somebody who is going to invest in, fill-in-the-blank pharmaceutical company and therefore be more likely to recommend their drug because I want the stock to go up so my investment is improved. What we're talking about here is unintended influence because of these potentially competing interests. As an example of that, if you take a look at source number four, CMA policy document on guidelines for physicians in interactions with industry, practicing physicians should not accept personal gifts of any significant monetary or other value from industry. Now, what is a significant monetary gift is a good question. But what we're saying right now is you're not allowed to accept personal gifts. Physicians should be aware that acceptance of gifts of any value has been shown to have the potential to influence clinical decision making. It's not that you're a bad person. It's not that you're going to intentionally do this, but it biases the person. It influences the person. We tend to view people more positively when they give us things. That's just the nature of the beast. So that's what they're concerned about. And the same idea exists in Judaism. Take a look, please, at source number five. This is the Gemara in Ksuvos. This is a key passage in the Talmud where they talk about conflicts of interest and bribes in a judicial context. Take a look at it. The Hebrew word for a bribe is shochad. So that's key for understanding this. Source number five. The Gemara asks, why is a bribe forbidden? I'm reading out my English translation, but you can see the original Hebrew there as well. Why is a shochad, a bribe, forbidden? Because once one accepts a bribe from someone, one's mind becomes close to him, and he is like his person, his own person. And one cannot see guilt for himself. In other words, somebody gives you something, you tend to view them like yourself. And just like it's hard to see guilt in ourselves, it's hard for us to see guilt in the person who benefited us. And then they ask, what is shochad? The word shochad, which means bribe, this is not literal etymology, but it is shehu chad, which I believe here means he or it is one. In other words, you and the person who gave this to you become one in your mind. You could also translate it as it is sharp, but I don't think that's the intention here. It means it is one. So the concern we have is that you become you feel close to the person who gave you the gift. And that's the concern we have. Not that the medical professionals are bad people, but simply that you get influenced and you don't even realize it. Questions, comments on that so far? Nope, we're good? Okay. I mean, I didn't think it was particularly controversial, but let's go further then and start talking about our first vignette. The first vignette is actually the one that that triggered this session. It was an email that I received from somebody who was invited to a particular pharmaceutical presentation. The company was presenting their drug. And the question was, not exactly what you see here on the sheet, because I try to anonymize things, but they're doing it with some kind of incentive for participation. Is it okay to go to the presentation? That was the question that I was asked. So here we go. Susan, a psychologist resident at Mount Sinai Hospital, is invited to a presentation by Asuta Pharmaceuticals on a new antidepressant they have developed. The presentation will take place in a kosher steakhouse with dinner served free of charge. Is it halachically appropriate for Susan to participate? She's getting a free dinner. Is it okay for her to participate in this session on the antidepressant? She herself is a psychologist, so it's her field. What would you say?
I say it's appropriate.
Okay,
I think it's appropriate also. And the reason I think it's appropriate, because not only is Susan a psychologist, she'll never prescribe on the in New York State, if she's Mount Sinai in New York State.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, she'll learn a great deal. And this question will come up also, can you be an expert and come to one of these dinners and be paid for your time? But the fact of the matter is that she will learn a lot. And I'm not sure she's going to be influenced for this medication in particular, but she'll learn some facet about this medication that may be very important for her in her understanding of her patients.
So the presentation is valuable, you're saying. And it's true. I gave the case that she's a psychologist and not a psychiatrist. I'm not sure why I did that. I should have made it a psychiatrist so that it would be a stronger question. Because, yes, it's true. Psychologists, at least in theory, aren't prescribing this. In practice is another story. Sorry, what?
It's only dinner.
Oh, don't say it's only dinner. How many kosher steakhouses do you have in Toronto?
Too many.
One. And it's very expensive.
Exactly. Don't tell me.
The minute she joins that, why isn't that a bribe? It's shochad. She's definitely influenced by the fact, what's the difference between getting a dinner and getting a gift? It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely an argument.
In the US, they ban that. You're not allowed to do that anymore.
So we're going to talk about what the law says, and we're going to talk about what Judaism says. Other thoughts?
I have a question. Yeah.
1 second.
Okay, John Pito.
Hi.
I was thinking about that many years ago. Oh, my God, these doctors have been getting free dinners.
Yeah.
Do you realize that that evening you have fallen behind on your charts and your communication and your prescription and your faxes, and the next day you're going to be toast, you're exhausted, so you lost much more than the value of a dinner. And some of those are not great dinners either. I mean, if you didn't attend a dinner, then you would be able to buckle down between 8 and 10 and finish your bloody day.
So that's interesting. So Dr. Pito presents the opposite argument from Dr. Block's argument. Dr. Block is talking about your benefit as a practitioner from exposure to the presentation. Dr. Pito says, yeah, but you have responsibilities that you're not taking care of because you're hanging out at the dinner instead, aside from the comment on the quality of the dinner, which I'm not going to weigh in on at all. Jeff Lipsitz, one second, hang on. Jeff raised his hand. So Jeff gets special treatment. Go ahead.
I saw the button. Thank you. I had a thought as you were asking this question, and it is, if you go to one dinner, you may be unduly influenced by the manufacturer of the product that is being discussed. However, if you go to rounds every month, and each one is sponsored by a different company, then it seems to me the shochad kind of cancels out, because it's like they're subsidizing your medical school application. At some point, you can't keep track who paid for which dinner, and you'll probably be relatively unbiased.
That's great. So now what you're saying is just go to a lot of them, and you'll be okay.
Yep.
Awesome.
Unless you're diabetic.
Right. This is true. Sharon, you had your hand up before. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, I did. First of all, I've done a fair number of courses through Sunnybrook and Scarborough, and you're not even allowed to accept a pen from pharma, okay, in Toronto, Canada. Those are the rules. And the other thing is you can go to dinners if they've given an unrestricted grant to a speaker or a number of different speakers. They said that's what they say now, and that's the non-ethical, non-Jewish, it's ethical, but it's not the Jewish viewpoint. I don't know if it clashes, but you can go to dinners as long as it's an unrestricted grant and that the person who is giving the talk is non-biased.
Interesting.
So they may put in the name of this new drug, but they'll also mention the other drugs that are available to do the similar things. And if this is a new thing, then they can show the research on it.
Right.
But I think it's very wrong to accept a dinner where they're only discussing one drug.
You might be able to accept the pen, by the way. Based on the reading that I did, the pen, even if it's branded, you might be able to accept the pen. There is literature on it. I'm just not 100% sure, and I don't want to say that without checking back. But I believe that materials like that are actually okay. Okay, there were a few other hands. I saw the note in the chat. I generally avoid reading the chat during these because I post the links so often that I can't actually follow what's going on in the chat. Let's see. I saw a few hands. Ben.
Yeah. I like to go to the dinners to learn about these drugs, because particularly the side effects, because I see the patients much more often than the psychiatrists do. And that way I can pick up if they're experiencing a side effect more quickly than the psychiatrist will, and can get them to contact the psychiatrist or whatever is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's clinically beneficial to go.
Right. So definitely, I think what you're saying is correct. It isn't really just about psychiatrists. Psychiatrists are the most obvious target, but definitely not the only one. That's definitely true. Andrea, Dr. Stern.
Okay, just repeating what some people have already said. Psychologists, at least in Canada, can't prescribe medication, but
correct.
If you change that to a psychiatry resident, residents are, I'm not sure if they're forbidden, but they are certainly advised not to attend any pharma lunches, dinners, whatever. I can't really say that I've been invited to any recently.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give you my experience, I know that again, if you're speaking, even if it's sponsored by a drug company, even if there's no lunch or whatever attached to it, yes, they are supposed to bring in generic names as opposed to trade names.
Yes, indeed. That's a big one, is the issue of using generic. Some of you may remember when I gave the class in October on Ozempic, So the that actually held up the accreditation for our classes for the year. The fact that I had Ozempic in the title, and so I changed it to semaglutide because I don't care. It wasn't meant to promote a particular medication. But yeah, no, they're very sensitive to that. So yes, that issue is an issue. I'm going to take two more hands that I see up right now, and then we're going to go further.
One more comment about my personal experience as a speaker.
Yeah.
Many years ago when nicotine replacement therapy came out, there was only Nicoderm, but trying to be, I used generic terms. I was never asked to come back as a speaker.
Yeah.
But we're talking many years ago.
I second that. Okay. Not against you, but against the use of the generics to the point where you dilute the message. That was actually a concern with the Ozempic session, because sometimes it actually matters. You know, there we were talking about the popularization of it. But I'm just going to go over to...
In this case, it didn't matter. It's just because I wouldn't use the name Nicoderm. So after the talk, he didn't say, I'm never going to ask you back as a speaker, but he sort of took me to task for not mentioning the specific name.
I hear you. Okay. Thank you. Dr. Felder and then Dr. Block, and then we're going to move into the issue.
I guess two thoughts. One is that I think the assumption of going to dinner and hearing from the speakers that you'll hear pretty unbiased stuff. But in my experience also, the slides that the speakers present are provided by the pharmaceutical industry itself. And so they're the ones, it's not as though the speaker is speaking from his or her own knowledge. And so when the information is finally provided by the pharmaceutical industry itself that produces the manufacture of the medication, it's hardly unbiased. And so if we were to say this is the best place to go to learn unbiased information about this medication, I think we'd be fooling ourselves. Or that this is the best way to do it. The other thing is that I think that that the cost of the meal, let's say 30 or 40 people go, and let's say they're paying hundreds of dollars on the speaker and all this sort of stuff, the amount of cost when I approached pharmaceuticals before, say, if you really want to help me, you'd probably buy me $500 worth of amoxicillin or buy me a lung function machine or something that actually helps the patient. You know, so that when we look at the amount of money that's spent, and that's just one meal, we would say thousands of dollars are spent for one meal. And if we really wanted to benefit patients, that would not be the way to do it. We would come up with far better ways of benefiting patients.
Well,
I mean, for benefiting patients, that would be it.
I could argue that point, but I don't think it's useful right now. I think that you can make the argument against that. But in terms of the overall point, all the literature talks about the need to be skeptical when you go to a session like this to ensure that you don't simply buy what they're telling you because of the very real possibility that, look, they're marketing their drug. They're not there to give you a comprehensive understanding of the field and the pluses and minuses of theirs versus others. That's not why they're in business. Okay, the last one. Dr. Herman, I see your hand, but I had really said that I'm going to just take Dr. Block's and then move on. There's just too much right now. Sorry. Dr. Block, Sana, what do you have?
As a rebuttal against the last speaker, the fact of the matter is the FDA, at least in the United States, actually tells you which slides you can use. Mm-hmm. And they actually go over every slide. And as a presenter on several occasions, I presented a great deal of knowledge, and there's questions and answers afterwards, which breaks the rules of the FDA that the expert can then give that will rebut whatever is said before if there's something in there that's controversial. Really, is there anything controversial in there? Because it's already been examined by the FDA before you can even possibly put it up. And the presenter is instructed that you shall not deviate from any of these slides in any way whatsoever, except when people ask you personal questions afterwards.
Very interesting. Okay, that's information I wasn't aware of. All right, so is it okay to go to the dinner? Isn't it okay to go to the dinner? So from a secular, policy perspective, I believe the answer is you are able to go within the Canadian rules. It is taken as a given in the literature that relationships between industry and medical professionals are necessary for the good of the patient. You're not looking to eliminate relationships between industry and medical professionals. I brought you in source number 6 from CMA Policy Guideline for Physicians and Interactions with Industry. This is from the beginning of the document. They say the history of healthcare delivery in Canada has included interaction between physicians and the pharmaceutical and health supply industries. This interaction has extended to research as well as to education. It's prolific, and this line doesn't point to the necessity, but it points to the fact that really the ties go deep. In terms of the meal, it looks to me, first of all, what I've heard over and over again from people when I ask them this question, people in the medical profession in Canada, is, yeah, of course you're able to go to the dinner. That's the general response that I get from people. But if you take a look at source number 7, it seems fairly clear that this is okay based on the CMA's guidelines. Practicing physicians should not accept a fee or equivalent consideration from pharmaceutical manufacturers or distributors in exchange for seeing them in a promotional or similar capacity. You're not allowed to accept a fee for seeing them. So if they say, we want to show up at your office and tell you about our drug, you can't say, sure, pay me $75 and I'll listen to your presentation. That would not be allowed. That's a no-no. But take a look at number 8, number 7, that's all it says. It doesn't say anything about not accepting a meal. The College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, in their document on physicians' relationships with industry, says the following. Where industry representatives are providing information about products or services, physicians are permitted to accept meals for themselves and appropriate staff. However, physicians must only accept meals that are of a modest value. The bold there on the word must is in the original document from the CPSO. I didn't add that. They have to only accept meals that are of modest value. Physicians are advised to consider the reasonable expectations of their patients in assessing whether a meal is modest. Would your patient consider this an influence on you, or would your patient say that this is... an expensive gift that you've been given? So you could definitely now argue about modest value when you're talking about a kosher steakhouse. Like, that's not the same scale as what they're usually providing, I suspect. It is more expensive. But as a general principle, leaving outside of it, you know, the kosher steak dinner, but in general, it seems like it's okay for you to go to a meal and to sit through the presentation. And as far as Dr. Pito's concern about, well, when is you going to get your work done? The answer is you're going to have to figure that out. That would seem to be the way it works. Within Judaism, we have greater concerns. Your starting point within Torah is when you talk about the judicial system. That's where you find most of the literature, and that may not carry over outside of the judicial system, but we'll talk about that. First, we look at the judges, and we have a very strong concern about potential bias. Take a look at source number 9. This is a large passage in the Talmud. I brought you a piece of it regarding the issue of potential bias for a judge. The Talmud asks, and what is a verbal bribe? Can you give me what would constitute a verbal bribe? What does that mean? Like when Shmuel crossed a river on a ferry and somebody extended his hand to him. Shmuel asked, why are you here? It just happens that we're on the same road together. What are you doing here? He said, well, actually, I have litigation. And Shmuel said, I am disqualified to judge for you. Even though no money changed hands, you helped me across the river, now I will no longer be impartial. Another story. Amemar, one of the sages also, was judging when a feather landed on his head. Someone removed it. Amemar asked, why are you here? He replied, I have litigation. Amemar said, I am disqualified to judge for you. I can't be impartial anymore. Next story. Mar Ukva, also one of the sages, spat before himself. He had phlegm or whatever it was. He spits it out on the ground. And someone covered it. That's a polite gesture. Mar Ukva asked, why are you here? He replied, I have litigation. Mar Ukva said, I am disqualified to judge for you. So three straight cases, followed by a fourth case. The sharecropper of Rabbi Yishmael, son of Rabbi Yossi, regularly brought him a basket of the rabbi's own fruit on Fridays, right? Remember the way sharecropping works? You're working somebody else's land, and you receive a percentage of the produce, and the rest of the produce goes to the owner of the field. So Rabbi Yishmael, son of Rabbi Yossi, owns a field. He's not working the field. Somebody else is working it, and every Friday, the guy brings him, you know, his own stuff, the produce, the share that belongs to Rabbi Yishmael, son of Rabbi Yossi. Once he brought it to him on Thursday, brought it a day early. So Rabbi Yishmael, son of Rabbi Yossi, said, why'd you do it differently this time? And he said, I have litigation. And I said, I'll bring it to the master while I'm here. I'm here to see you anyway for the court case. So I'm also bringing this to you. Rabbi Yishmael, son of Rabbi Yossi, did not accept it from him. And he said, I am disqualified to judge for you. He set up a pair of sages, and they judged for him. While he, Rabbi Yishmael, son of Rabbi Yossi, was walking, he said, you know, if he wanted, he could argue this way in his case. If he wanted, he could argue that way in his case. And then he said to himself, wow, may the recipients of bribes perish. I didn't accept the bribe. Had I accepted, it would have been my own produce. And yet, look at me, I'm biased for this guy. How much more so for recipients of bribes? Just the fact that he showed he wanted to benefit me already caused me to be sympathetic to his case. So this is where we are concerned. We really worry about the potential for showing favor to somebody because they showed favor to you. Clear? Is the source clear? Whether you like it, don't like it, is not the question right now. That's just the passage in the Talmud itself. And now I'm going to go one step further. Adina, I see your hand. Hang in there.
Okay, I have a question on this, though.
Yeah, no, I just want to show you number 10, and then I'll take comment and question on that as well. So this is much more recent, right? Mordechai Yaakov Breisch. You see, I wrote there 20th century, Poland, Germany, Switzerland. In my humble opinion, he's dealing with a case in which somebody returned a lost object that belonged to a judge. And now the judge wants to know, am I allowed to judge the case? So he says, in my humble opinion, it is simple that one may not judge him, if only as a stringency and special piety. And it's likely even by law. At the very least, it's inappropriate to judge him. But it may even be law that you may not. It is obvious this is no more than the sharecropper case, Rabbi Shmuel, son of Rabbi Yossi, and Shmuel crossing that river. Even though that person who did him a favor was performing a mitzvah, it's part of honoring a Torah sage, and yet he said, I am disqualified to judge. It's the same thing. If a guy returns your lost object, he's doing a mitzvah, but you can't now be his judge. And according to the Rambam, in the laws of the Sanhedrin, he is even disqualified by law as per Kesef Mishnah. We're going to come back to that shortly. And even according to Tosfo there and other authorities, it is still a matter of stringency and piety. We'll see what he's talking about with that. But the bottom line out of these sources is an incredible sensitivity to the possibility of bias. Adina.
So in that first example that you gave, wouldn't it be biased? Sorry. The fact that they have a business relationship to begin with, even if he didn't bring it to him the day before, the fact that he brought it to him on Thursday as opposed to on Friday, the fact that they have a pre-existing relationship,
yeah.
Shouldn't that disqualify him already?
So I was wondering about that also. Why wouldn't he have been disqualified for their existing business relationship? I have to admit, I'm not sure. I was wondering about it as I was reading it. It didn't occur to me before, but yeah, it's a good question. Not clear on that. Sharon.
Okay, just one practical question and one otherwise. For how long has he got to recuse himself for a small act of kindness?
Good.
I mean, maybe it wasn't kindness. Like is that forever? Or
right.
Is that just one incident? And the other thing is, you know, to me, it sounds like the guy was going to the courthouse anyway.
Yeah.
And it was on his way, and he thought he'd save a trip.
Yeah.
He gave him the stuff a day earlier. Why is it considered a bribe?
So here's something very important, and I thank you for asking that question. The word bribe in our language tends to have evil associations with it. The assumption of wicked intent to influence somebody. But the way it's being used here is it's describing a gift that was given by A to B, regardless of the intention of A in giving the gift. And the case here, you're 100% right. It's not that the sharecropper is trying to influence the case. However, the result can still be influence, because we tend to look at people favorably when they do nice things to us or when they indicate that they want to help us. So it doesn't matter that his intention was pure. That's the issue. But you're right, the word bribe has certain associations.
I don't know. And how long does it... Are they
right. So going back to that point, thank you. So unclear. One of the things that I left on the cutting room floor was a very interesting discussion in a Tosfos in Bava Basra. They're talking there about a financial relationship between parties versus a familial relationship between parties. And they say there that where the reason for disqualification is financial, then it's only as long as the financial relationship exists. Where the reason for the disqualification is family, it outlives the family relationship. So, example, if people are in-laws, but then one of the spouses passes away, they're still disqualified for each other, even though that marriage relationship that united them is no longer in existence. It would even be true if there was a divorce where you'd argue, well, now they hate each other. It doesn't make a difference. The family relationship lasts longer. What I don't know is the answer to your question about this case, which is neither family nor financial. It's simply positive feeling about the other because of the favor they did. I think logically you would have to dictate a statute of limitations on it, but I'm not sure what that would be, how that would work, other than polling people and asking, so what do you think? Like going by what people's expectations are. That could be it. I saw a couple of notes that flew by me in the chat about people's experiences at these dinners. I think one note mentioned that, at least in the United States, there's actually a requirement if you go to one of these dinners to file a form and that it becomes visible on some kind of physician profile. I want to know where you can access those profiles, because I've never actually seen those. But that was that's an interesting point for sure. And then the other note, that the dinners, generally speaking, don't teach you just about the sponsor's product, because the attendees talk to each other about the alternatives. There's Q&A. So it isn't just the biased presentation. That's reassuring to hear. Janine.
I understand the stringency in the case of a judge, because there's a mitzvah from the Torah. There are ways that a judge has to behave. Can you generalize that stringency to doctor's conduct?
Yes, so that's where I'm going with this. If you take a look at... Actually, did I end up bringing it on here? I think I did. No, you know what? I cut it for space. Oh, first, before I get to that, sorry, I almost jumped a step. I didn't cut it for space. We're getting to what you asked, but I'm not there yet. That's why. The question of whether these cases are indicative of law or personal stringency is actually a debate between sources 11 and 12. Source number 11, Tosfos, commenting on that passage in the Gemara, says, "Eino ela chumra be'alma." What these rabbis did to disqualify themselves as judges, because you helped me across the river, because you blew the feather, because you covered the phlegm, that was astringency. Shayimachmirin alatzman, they were strict with themselves, as you find in various areas. But they were not disqualified. It was just a stringency. That's one view. However, the Rambam Maimonides codifies the disqualification in his code of law, Mishneh Torah, and Rabbi Yosef Karo, author of the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, but also author of the Kesef Mishneh commentary on the Rambam, says in source number 12, our master, meaning the Rambam, thought that in all of these cases they refrained from judging not only out of piety, but because this was the letter of the law. Not like the view of Tosafot, who wrote this was just piety. Both of these were referenced in Rabbi Breish in source number 10. That was the piece at the end of source number 10. What I want to add to this is that it's not only Judaism that has this high standard of disqualification according to Maimonides, according to the Rambam, but also the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority. They were much stricter than what I saw in the CMA and what I saw in the CPSO. Take a look at number 13. They have a series of questions, frequently asked questions. Can an industry representative take a WRHA representative out to lunch or dinner for a business purpose? Now, I should note, this isn't now about doctors. This is about government, and that may be why they're stricter, along the lines of saying judges should be stricter. When you're an authority representing government, maybe the rules are different. But they said a meal is considered a personal gift and should be respectfully declined. It's nice they said respectfully. We suggest instead that industry representatives be invited to meet with WRHA representatives in accordance with the site access provisions of this policy. That's what they want. It continues with question 5. An industry representative who is either at an industry-sponsored conference or on-site at a WRHA-sponsored event has asked me and a couple of others to dinner following the event. May I accept? Answer, no, for the same reason stated above. However, if you pay for your dinner and do not discuss business, that's just fine. You can go hang out with the industry representatives. They can be your best friends. Question 6. If I'm attending a national meeting, a vendor hosts a noon luncheon or other similar event open to all attendees. It's not just me being invited to a meal. It's for everybody. May I enjoy the meal or event? Yes, if the event or meal is open to all attendees, in such cases it is viewed as part of your registration and conference attendance. However, you may not accept additional entertainment or benefits limited to only a few attendees, such as an invitation to dinner, tickets for sporting events, etc. And then the last one was question 7. I just thought that was interesting. What if your spouse got an invitation and your spouse does not work for this government organization? Are you allowed to go with your spouse? And they said, your spouse can attend alone, but if you accompany the spouse, you have to pay for both meals. How do you like that one? Okay. So just showing you that standards do vary. And again, it may really be because the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority is government. The rules really may change for that. One more note on this, and then I'm going to come back to the question of whether this applies beyond judges. But take a look at source number 14 from that same passage in the Talmud. Very important. What if the doctor says, I believe in this drug anyway. I was prescribing this drug anyway. But they're offering me a kosher steakhouse dinner. Like, I'm going to say yes. And then I'm going to go back to prescribing the drug that I was prescribing before anyway. Take a look at this. The Torah says, you shall not accept a bribe. What does this teach? If it's to teach that he shouldn't find the guilty innocent or the innocent guilty, the Torah already says, don't warp judgment. Right? You didn't need to tell me don't take bribes to tell me that I shouldn't be dishonest when I judge cases. Rather, even if the payment is encouragement to find the innocent innocent and the guilty guilty, they say to me, I'm giving this to you in all sincerity, saying, just judge honestly. If I win, I win. If I lose, I lose. The Torah says, no, you shall not accept a bribe. Even in a case like that, it's not acceptable. And so you say, well, I was prescribing this anyway. Doesn't make a difference. You're not allowed to accept the gift. But now to go back to Janine's question. What about people other than judges? So take a look at source number 15. Rabbi Moshe Isserles. He's talking about the laws of an apotropos, a legal guardian appointed to manage the estate of a vulnerable party. So he says, some say that just as a guardian may invest with other people, the guardian is able to take the estate and invest it in different ways, so he may accept the investment for his own ventures, so long as the rabbinical court oversees it due to concern for gossip. We're okay with the idea that you're going to invest it in your own venture, but only if there's going to be court oversight, because we are concerned about the potential for influence. But not only for a legal guardian, where you could argue, fine, but the guardian is an officer of the court in a certain sense, and maybe therefore the guardian has special standing. Take a look at source number 16, Rabbi Yom Tov Lipman Heller, his Papula Charifta commentary to the Rush. He says, I wrote this, that which he's been discussing right before this, to teach that public officials, even though their decisions are not Torah judgments, they're not judges, they're not empowered for that, they still must be careful not to accept gifts for issuing rulings. The public official is not allowed to accept gifts. You'll tell me, okay, fine, but that's government. Take a look at number 17. This is a classic story. This responsum from Chasam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, is always a great example. The people of a certain town gathered to hire a rabbi and teacher, and they agreed regarding four rabbis to place their names in a box and then to vote on each name as it would be withdrawn. So put the names in the box, and then one by one take them out of the box, and people will cast their vote. The third candidate won the majority of votes. After several days, the masses raised a stormy voice, for many of the people had accepted monetary bribes from the relatives of that rabbi to appoint him upon them. It is as obvious as the kashrut of an egg in yogurt, which is an expression that the Talmud uses when it wants to say a case is obvious, that just like you would know that an egg in yogurt is kosher, it's not a meat and dairy problem, so too you know that whatever case they're dealing with is fine. But here it's the opposite. He says, it's as obvious as the fact that an egg in yogurt is kosher, that's how obvious it is that this vote is void. For they were required to voice their opinions altruistically, as recorded by Rama. Rabbi Moshe Isserles says, when there is a vote in the community, people are responsible to vote altruistically, not based on personal interest. So we see that there is a concern for bias that goes beyond judges, extends even to the community voting in an election. But I'll show you that it even goes beyond public interest. And that's because our fundamental concern that we have is for a mitzvah that applies to everybody. And that is the mitzvah of Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Mechshol. Don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind. If you give somebody bad advice, you're in violation of that mitzvah. So that's really what this comes down to. The whole discussion about potential bribes and potential influence really, at bottom is, if you give somebody advice and there's an element of self-dealing in doing so, and you give him bad advice as a result, you violated this prohibition. That's what we're worried about. Now, I brought you source number 18, in which Rabbi Moshe Isserles contends that somebody who gives bad advice is not financially liable for the fallout, because fundamentally the harm you caused him was indirect. You told him this drug was good for him. He took the drug and either spent money on something that was useless or it had a side effect that was bad. Your role was considered indirect. He says, one who harms another person via the advice he provides, all of these are exempt, all the cases that Rabbi Isserles mentions there, including this one, are exempt from liability in court because it was only indirect causation of harm. It's indirect. However, indirect acts do carry liability, just not in a rabbinical court. They carry liability with God, who is known to claim his debts. If you take a look at source number number 19, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein in the Aruch HaShulchan makes this point. He says, as a general rule, one must know that even though one is not liable in human court for indirectly causing harm, for reasons that will be explained, and we've already discussed a little bit, still, one must not do it. And one who does so is liable in the heavenly court. So it may not be actionable in rabbinical court, but he is going to get into trouble. Now, lest you say, but I'm not profiting from doing this, right? I went to the dinner. I already got the kosher dinner. There are no strings attached where I'm going to have to pay them something if I don't prescribe their medication. So really, I'm not profiting from what I'm doing now. The answer is, that may be true, but it doesn't change the fact that you're liable because you are acting under their influence and as a result, harming this party. If you take a look at source number 20, last source on this vignette, Rabbi Moshe Isserles says the following. He's talking about a case in which you have three parties. You have a lender, a borrower, and a third party. The third party encouraged the lender to extend the loan, telling him that the borrower is good for it. So even if one did not explicitly guarantee a loan, but he told the lender to lend to the borrower because, he said, the borrower is reliable, and the lender acted on his word, which turned out to be false, he must pay. It is as though he guaranteed the loan. When you say, this is good, we hold you at your word. That's what I'm trying to show here. So at bottom, you won't find a straightforward statement of Jewish law prohibiting the doctor from going to the dinner. But I think what we're seeing here is that the doctor is going to need to exercise proper judgment, even if civil law and the regulations of the industry will allow for it. It's something you have to think about carefully. Now, there was a note in the chat earlier, I think from Dr. Lieberman, saying that there's this 1099 form and it'll all be reported and so on. And that leads to the question of, let's say I accept whatever gift it is, I accept the dinner, and I'm going to tell my patients about it. Is that sufficient? If I'm going to report it to the patient so the patient will know who might be speaking in my ear, is that okay? So that's what we're going to get to in vignette number 4. That's where we talk about the issue of reporting. Questions or comments on vignette number 1? We spent most of our time on vignette number 1, but I knew that was going to happen. It's the most complicated out of all the cases. Okay, let's see vignette number 2. So this is a social issue. Take a look back on the first side of the sheet. Sorry, this is halachic issue, not social. It's halachic coming through a social context. One Shabbat at the synagogue Kiddush, Susan is approached by her friend Lisa. Lisa explains that her teenage daughter is exhibiting what seemed to be signs of an eating disorder. Lisa is terrified and this is social. Hang on, what did I do? I just want to make sure I understand what I did here. Oh, I see what I did. Okay, it is social. All that happened was on the headings, it should say for vignette number 2, the headings should say social, and on the third one, it should say halacha. That's all. This is the social one. Sorry. In any case, Lisa explains that her teenage daughter is exhibiting what seemed to be signs of an eating disorder. Lisa is terrified and wants to bring her daughter to Susan. But Susan's practice is closed to new patients. She explains that she has been waitlisting new patients for the past 6 months because she needs the time to serve her current patients. Lisa is beside herself. After Shabbat, she calls Susan, pleading with her. What should Susan do? So where is the conflict of interest here?
Because they're friends from shul.
Right, but what are the interests on both sides? I just want to make sure we articulate it.
Other people can't get into the same practice even if they meet suitable medical criteria because this practitioner is
playing favorites with a personal friend or someone who knows for sure.
That's one issue. And the other issue is she closed her practice because she felt she wasn't able to care for her patients. So it's really pitting the interests of her current patients against the interests of her friend. Right?
In real life, I'm sure that happens all the time.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Serving current patients, or is it she would be taking time when she wouldn't typically be dealing with patients, but her family or her own family?
Right. So that's why I formulated the vignette the way that I did, is that it's actually at the expense of the existing ones. If you go back to the case, it's specifically because she's been waitlisting new patients because she needs the time to serve her current patients. So we're not assuming that she's just going to take it out of her own time. I would also add that when a professional starts to reduce their own time, and certainly a doctor who already is reducing their own time to be able to take care of patients, they run the risk that they're going to diminish the quality of care that they provide because they don't have the downtime that they need. So that's an added problem, says the rabbinic profession. So this is a real issue. So what would you say? What does Susan do?
Susan should call one of her friends, one of her colleagues, and ask if they'll take her on.
Right.
I don't think we should touch this patient because, I mean, they go to the same shul. The mother's going to be pestering her about what's going on, and you haven't seen her enough times and whatever. I wouldn't touch this with a 10-foot pole. halakhically or otherwise.
Right. Well, that goes back to our discussion about practicing medicine in the Jewish community altogether.
True.
Okay. Warren.
Well, yeah, I was going to say something similar. I mean, because you categorize this under social. So poor Susan, if she refuses this, like she's got to face these people at Kiddush every day and their family, and she's a rotten, no good nook in the shul, as opposed to she can come across as the, great person who helped this one, went out of her way and did it. So she's got a personal conflict over it.
Yes, very much so. This is totally no win situation, right? There's no good way that this scene ends, unfortunately. Dr. Block, and then I'm going to go into the case. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there are other forms of medicine in which you can do this and take your time out if it means your Sunday or whatever for a friend, and I've done that numerous times, and I don't think I was any way influenced by the fact that they were my friend or wasn't my friend, and they were from the shul, but I felt that it was a great stuck up to do it. When it comes to psychological and psychiatric issues, I think that's much more difficult.
Yeah.
There is another solution which you overlooked, which is you could recommend somebody who belongs to whatever mosque or synagogue who is a specialist in that field, and they may even do a better job for this poor kid.
Right, so that was Dr. Roth's suggestion, was, call your friend. And I think there's what to be said for it. But let's go through the issue a little bit. We have a conflict here in terms of her social need and the needs of her patients and potentially, her own needs. So we stipulate, first of all, that closing the practice to new patients for the sake of her current patients is absolutely respected within Jewish law. The idea that I need to make sure that I'm not harming my current patients is sound. And for that matter, you're able to turn away patients for other reasons as well. When we talked about the issue of vaccination and whether schools are able to turn away students for not vaccinating, I quoted an article by Rabbi J. David Bleich, who pointed out that schools are allowed to turn away students for financial reasons. Schools are allowed to turn away students if they feel students are disruptive. Not entirely, because then they are obligated to help them find an alternative educational path. But the point is, there is a liberty to say, I am protecting my current patients by turning this patient away. And I brought you source number 21. This is an article by J. David Bleich on physician strikes. And I bring it here because of one line that you'll see. He says, an interesting point regarding the level of services which must be provided is reflected in a letter. He's talking about the issue of what, you know, if you're on strike, what kind of service do you have to provide? It's reflected in a letter addressed to the medical staff of Shaare Tzedek Hospital, signed by two leading rabbinic authorities and published in the Kislev 5744 issue of Asya. This was 1984. The signatories, Rabbi Yitzchak Yaakov Weiss, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, report that it had come to their attention that the number of physicians available to treat patients fell below the number of physicians customarily on duty on Shabbat. Assuming that the Shabbat staff is the minimum necessary for purposes of pikuach nefesh, of saving lives, those authorities declared that the members of the medical staff are obligated to assure the presence of medical personnel not fewer in number than on the holy Sabbath days. So in other words, you need to make sure that life and death is taken care of. That's the requirement. You're not allowed to turn away somebody in a life and death situation. Now, we're talking eating disorders. We had a session, I don't remember if it was last year or the year before, where we discussed eating disorders, and without any doubt, they qualify as pikuach nefesh, safek pikuach nefesh, potential threat to life, and therefore Susan does face a greater imperative. So Susan will be obligated to do what Sharon recommended before, what I see Abby Diamond wrote in the chat. I think at least one other person had suggested it as well. I think this is correct. I think the answer is that there is a duty for Susan to find somebody who will be able to cover, even if Susan is not able to do so herself. I think that responsibility is there. Dr. Glogauer.
Hi, thank you. And I also think that because it is a potential life or death situation, you can't just take it on for any reason because you need special training and expertise in treating disorders,
yes.
Treating eating disorders.
Absolutely, 100%. Okay, so this is certainly true. Yes, owner. I don't know.
Some boss or some friend asks you to work this in your schedule. It's not like, I mean, realistically, in the Rambam, you hear about his practice, that it would interfere with everybody else, but most of us have other times, and we take our own time or our family time, and it's not dangerous, it's just not something we want to do. We have scheduled time that we see patients, and we want to keep it to that. But when somebody comes, you know, some higher-up person or some rabbi or somebody else that you respect and like to do something, you change it.
Right. So, you know, where there is that kind of leeway to say, well, I'm going to, let this come out of my other time, then it goes back to the question of, will that impair your practice or do you have that time available to give? In the event that you tell me you have the time available to give, that's great. And certainly when you're dealing with an eating disorder case or something of similar severity, that's what I would suggest doing. At the same time, it is legitimate, and we talked about this in a session, it's years ago already, but it is legitimate for a doctor to say, I need a certain amount of downtime in order to be able to function well. And that's something that each individual has to know for themselves. There's no hard number, and I suspect it's a number that changes for people in the course of a lifetime. At different stages, they have different needs. Adina.
What if Lisa is insistent and says, listen, I only trust you, this is my kid, she's really in desperate situation. Like you said, this could be pikuach nefesh, and Lisa doesn't trust
another doctor that Susan, she trusts Susan because Susan is her friend, her shul member. She's a good doctor. Clearly she's really good because she closed her practice because she has so many people she's taking care of. So what if Lisa is kind of insistent and pushing and saying, well, I don't trust anybody else and I really want only right. you.
It's a good question. First of all, I see another hand up, but I'm going to have to go further with vignette three after addressing this, just because we need to do... what I really want to do is make sure to get to vignette four, because vignette four is going to be where we talk about reporting. And I need to make sure we get... and we're going to see three and four. We're going to manage it. What I'm going to suggest is, Adina, it's a good question. Maybe at the end we'll come back to it, because I want to make sure to get to three and four. Five... I don't have much to add to what we said about it in the dementia class, but three and four we really should get to. So that's where we're going to go. I will remind people, if you didn't sign in yet in the chat and you want to get a credit letter, please make sure that you do so. And I see the suggestion, if the child is in that dire of a state, she needs to be seen in an ED. Possibly. The problem is, what do you do after the emergency department? But, okay. Vignette number three. That's the halachic conflict of interest. So, Susan has a patient. This is still the same Susan. Susan has a patient, Allison, age 25, who is dating a young man, Baruch, seriously. The families of Susan, Allison, and Baruch all attend the same synagogue. So, the doctor, the young man, the young woman, are all from the same synagogue. Allison tells Baruch that she is seeing Susan. And soon afterward, Baruch's mother asks Susan about Allison's mental health. What should Susan do? The answer is she should yell at the mother and say, you know I'm not allowed to talk to you, and I don't even know why you're having this conversation with me. And, you know, I'm sure that's exactly what's going to happen. So what exactly do you, what exactly happens in this situation? So the conflict of interest formulation is... a halachic interest, as well as a social interest, versus what might be the patient's best interest, right? We assume the patient's best interest is confidentiality. That's a, you know, that's an assumption. I'm not 100% sure that this patient is actually best served by going ahead with Allison, but, you know, let's go with it. The so Baruch's best interest as the patient is that Susan should say nothing. However, Susan has a problem because, first of all, she has a friend who's asking her this question, and she may have a halachic obligation, depending on what the truth is of Baruch's mental circumstances. Maybe there's really an issue that Allison, not Allison's mother necessarily, but Allison should know about. So that's where things get challenging. Not only that, let's mix in the law, because the law here is most relevant. If you take a look at source number 22, FIPA, Personal Health Information Protection Act of Ontario. A health information custodian may disclose personal health information about an individual if the custodian believes on reasonable grounds that the disclosure is necessary for the purpose of eliminating or reducing a significant risk of serious bodily harm to a person or group of persons. So in the event that Susan knows that Baruch actually has a problem that makes him a risk to anybody who's going to become his partner, then there's a conversation. But barring that, if she's just seeing him for... what are, you know, mental health issues that occur in the population, there is absolutely zero justification in the eyes of the law for her to say anything to you know, Allison's mother. Frankly, I'm not even sure that she can say to Allison's mother that, yes, he's my patient. I'm not so sure that you can even do that. I can neither confirm nor deny. They, you know, that in and of itself is problematic. Why? Because as I brought in source 23 from the CMA, the Principles for the Protection of Patient Privacy, we have concerns, number one, for the good of the patient in terms of patient autonomy. Patients deserve to control the access to their information, but also because if word gets out that physicians spill information about their patients this easily, the result is going to be that people won't trust their physicians. right? They're not going to be willing to tell the psychologist anything because of fear of who is going to find this information. This would be a big problem. So this idea would be very challenging. I see the notes here in the chat, but I'm letting them scroll through because I want to make sure that we get through this. So the question is, what does Halacha want Susan to do? So we discussed this if you go back to those links in the beginning of the source sheet, a two-part session that we did on confidentiality back in 2011. But in brief, as a general principle, Jewish law is biased against sharing other people's personal information. We have prohibitions against Lashon Hara, saying anything negative about somebody, Rechilus, sharing stories about people, even when the stories are not negative. However, there are powerful arguments in Jewish law in favor of telling if Susan believes that the current condition, Baruch's current condition, could really be, I'm sorry, Allison's, I think I've been swapping Allison and Baruch a little bit. I hope I didn't get things wrong. If Susan really believes that Allison's current condition could be harmful in this relationship with Baruch, we have a principle. I brought you the Gemara in Sanhedrin in source number 24. The Torah says, don't stand by while somebody's blood is shed. This obligates me to act in the event that somebody is in danger. Not only that, as I highlighted in source 25, source 26, it's possible to argue that in the event that you don't disclose information that you have access to, and you, as a result, you give somebody bad advice, even through inaction, you're violating, do not put a stumbling block before the blind. If you say, there's nothing here, and there is something there, or just refuse to tell, that can be a violation of lifnei iver, putting a stumbling block before the blind. Which is why in Jewish law, we enable people to, and we require people, in fact, to tell other people's stories in order to prevent loss. And here I brought you in source number 26, a line specifically related to shiduchim. This is from the Pesachei Tshuva. All of the ethical works thunder regarding the sin of harmful speech. I thunder regarding the opposite, a greater sin, which is also more common, refraining from speaking when it is needed to save the victim from the victimizer. And in shidduch matters as well, when he knows this is a bad, worthless man, it will be bad to marry him. All of this is within the mitzvot of restoring health and wealth. You do have to spill the beans. Well, now I have a problem. Because what if poor Susan genuinely believes that this would be a bad match, that this could be a harmful match? And I don't mean harmful like he's an axe murderer, but harmful that a relationship is maybe not within his capacity at this time. Maybe he's narcissistic and self-driven and self-focused and not in a position to be a supportive husband. If she doesn't say anything, there could be real problems. So again, we talked about this at greater length when we had the patient confidentiality classes. But after giving those classes, years later, a responsum was published from Rav Usher Weiss, the Menchas Usher. He was dealing with an easier case, not a psychological case, but a case of heart problems. The story was that there was a young man who turned out to have a congenital heart defect. And it was a type of defect that could lead to, God forbid, sudden heart failure. It showed up because of something that happened. But the rest of his family had no idea. And this was something that was genetically based. So that, according to the information in Rav Usher Weiss's responsum, there was a 50% chance that his male first cousins would have this same defect. And they didn't know. And the doctor encourages this young man and his family to tell the cousins, and they don't want to because they are worried about shiduchim. They're worried about what's going to happen when word gets out that this defect is in the family. They're not going to be able to find somebody to marry, so they don't want to tell. So the doctor asks Rabbi Asher Weiss, what's my responsibility here? You're not allowed to share people's information. On the other hand, this is potentially a life and death issue. So Rav Asher Weiss points out, first of all, the arguments not to tell. He says the law of the land is the law. And if the law of the land is you're not allowed to disclose in such a case, we would have to respect that as the law. Assuming that that's really true, you'd have to get an ethics consult to find out whether you're allowed to tell in a case like this. Is this considered direct enough harm that you'd be allowed to? There's also an added concern for undermining the medical profession. On the other hand, he points out reasons why you should tell. There is a danger to these cousins who don't know, so much so that maybe the government would actually allow you to tell. Further, the next thing is actually an argument not to tell. I put it in the wrong place in my notes. Argument against telling is, in the event that you're not allowed to tell, if the government would not allow you to tell, you would not be required to endanger your livelihood by telling. So what does Rabbi Asher Weiss say to do? So when I gave this class in 2011, I still remember it to this day. It's very funny. We were on the third floor in the Bayit and sitting in rooms 1 and 2. They were merged. The accordion door was open. And I asked the medical professionals there, in a case like this, I didn't have Rav Asher Weiss's tshuva, it wasn't published at the time, but I presented a similar case. And I asked them, so what would you do? And their answer was, essentially, say something that would lead them to know there's something to investigate without actually telling them anything about this patient. Find a way to alert them without spilling the beans, was their answer. So lo and behold, Rabbi Asher Weiss says in source number 27, the correct counsel is for the doctor to cause the cousins to check. Cause them somehow to look into their, heart situation. Without disclosing this one's illness, he should find another strategy to explain to them why he is concerned for them, why he's suggesting that they check. And if he cannot act cleverly in this way, because there's just no way he's going to be able to do that, he should tell them that one of the family members carries this gene which could cause a heart attack without revealing who is afflicted and from which family and the like. He should find some way. Now, I don't know how that works. On the other hand, in his case, with a defect like that, I wonder if if an ethics consult wouldn't say he's allowed to provide information anyway. It's such a hard, it's hard information on a serious physical risk. But in terms of our case, in the event that there is real reason to believe that there is a risk at hand, that entering this relationship could be destructive, again, we would say, find some way to let them know. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to go to the fourth vignette. I'm going to go through that before 9 o'clock. I'll stick around afterwards for questions and comments because I feel bad about that, but I want to make sure that we see number 4 because it relates to the issue of disclosure. So in number 4, vignette number 4 was, David, an experienced primary care physician, often refers patients to dermatologists for examination of their moles. His sister marries Jonathan, a dermatologist. May David refer patients to Jonathan? Does he need to divulge their relationship? The person I'm sending you to is actually my brother-in-law. Is he allowed to do that? Does he have to disclose it? So when you're talking about family interest potentially versus patient interest, I have found nothing in law or CMA policy, CPSO policy regarding referral to family members. The U.S. has laws regarding financial interest. There is an anti-kickback statute in business. There's something called the Stark Law for physicians against self-referral. In source number 28, I gave you a list of legislation regarding issues of, as it's called here, fraud and abuse. But I haven't seen anything about family relationships. And in Judaism, you really only see it with judicial proceedings. You don't see it beyond judicial proceedings. However, there is an issue of disclosure. so that the patient will be able to consent and say, okay, I understand this is your brother-in-law, and I'm good with that. In judicial proceedings, Maimonides, the Rambam, brings this from a Mishnah, and it's brought in the Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law. It's source number 30 from Rabbi Yosef Karo. He says, a litigant is able to accept a relative of the other party or a disqualified party to be a judge or a witness. And if they perform a kinyan, a physical act demonstrating agreement, that's fine. That works, and that's binding. You can't back out once you have given that. But there does have to be consent. In order for there to be consent, there has to be full disclosure of the potential for bad advice. Meaning, it's not enough to say something very broad and vague, like I have a connection with this doctor who I'm sending you to. You have to be specific and say, this is my brother-in-law. And this is something that comes up in other areas of transactions in Jewish law, where we say disclosure has to be full and open disclosure. It isn't enough to be general. I brought you an example of it in source number 31, but I'm going to skip it because it isn't directly relevant here. So going back to our first vignette, the case with the kosher steakhouse dinner, I think there would be, even if you say you're allowed to go to it, you would need to disclose to the patient when you want to prescribe that medication. You'd have to let them know, you know, I was at a presentation that they did. They fed me a nice dinner. I believe this is the right medication for your case. I think that is what would be required. Somebody emailed me to ask me, what about investments in a drug company? What about if the doctor is an investor in a drug company and now wants to recommend the drug to people? So again, you would have to divulge your financial interest in that company when you are prescribing it. It's a requirement. Number one, because of the issue of lifnei iver, of giving bad advice, but also because of the problem of what kind of reputation you will develop otherwise. There's a separate issue of v'yisem nikiyim, being innocent in people's eyes. And in the event that it comes out that you prescribed a medication and you had shares in that company or you had received something from that company, that would wreak havoc on professional reputation. It would make you look very, very bad. And you would not be allowed to proceed. You have to disclose and make sure that people are aware. Is that clear? Did I go through that too quickly, or we're good? Vignette number 5, I didn't really have anything to add of significance to what we saw on this in the dementia case when we talked about children treating their parents. I only had it here, again, for the 3 reasons that I gave you in the very beginning of the session. But what we've seen, to sum it up in a nutshell, is that when you're dealing with financial issues, from a legal perspective, in the event that it's not a fee, but it's simply dinner during the presentation, if it's modest, it seems like you're probably okay from a civil law perspective, from a regulation of the profession perspective. Jewish law would tend to be a little stricter, according to the Rambam, not just as a stringency, but as a letter of the law thing. And certainly, I would say you would have an obligation to disclose it to the patient. Susan, who is approached by her friend Lisa, would have to try to find somebody to help with Lisa's daughter. And in the event that Susan could take her on by giving up some of her own time, that's a fine approach to the problem as well, assuming it won't harm Susan's patients. In terms of disclosure, where Jewish law would say that you should disclose, but it would harm the patient. So the ideal is to find a way to disclose without disclosing. Not to say anything explicit, but at the end of the day, the duty you owe to your current patient doesn't override this other person, assuming that there's a real concern for substantive harm. And that has to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. And then lastly, the business of referring to your family member, I think there is a duty to divulge the relationship. That's the nutshell summary. So it's 9 o'clock. Like I said, I'm going to let everybody go who needs to go. Please make sure you sign in before you go. And I'm going to stick around to discuss the issues. Thank you so much, everybody.